Israel has not lost its status. The 40th talk in a series on Romans was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 26, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, if I had been smart, I would have probably taken a couple of weeks off from our series in Romans, but that's if I had been smart, or if I was smart. So we're going to continue our series in Romans. I think we're coming to an end of this current section, and then we're going to take a break, and I'll come back to it in the spring to finish the book. But we're at chapter 11, and I think if all goes well, or at least as planned, we'll finish chapter 11 today. That seems like a lot in view of how slow we've been going, but I don't believe actually that chapter 11 of Romans is all that difficult in the final analysis. Once you get oriented to what it is he's doing, what the question is, and how he's approaching the question, it reads rather plainly, and it's pretty clear what he's doing. Romans 11 is debated a lot and misunderstood a lot. But the reason it's misunderstood, I think, is not because it's really difficult language or difficult interpretively. It's because we're not oriented to what it is he's doing. So once we get oriented to it, I think it'll unfold for us and become clear enough what he's doing. On my translation, if you are working off of my translation, it's part 28, paragraph 93. That's where I will begin reading. And I think what I'm going to do, since this is a rather large section, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read it in chunks and then comment on it as we go through it. Before we enter into this, before I start reading, you'll remember where we've been. When he got to the second part of his letter, he started responding to two questions that basically amount to objections that somebody might have to Paul's teaching. The first one is, Paul, if your teaching is true, then there's really no incentive that we have to live godly and righteous lives. We can go out and live however we want to, and God gives us salvation as a free gift. That doesn't make any sense, Paul, because God would certainly want us to live righteous lives. So he has to answer that question and explain how just because God gives us salvation as a gift by his grace, it doesn't mean that we can live any way we want to. And he explores that at great length. Then, in the section that we've been looking at most recently, he raises the question, Paul, if your teaching is true, then God has been unfaithful to his promises to his own people, the Jews. And we looked at that, where he says, no, he hasn't. You have misunderstood what promises he made to the Jews. The promises he made to the Jews were to the people as a group, a people group, not to individuals. There were no promises to individuals that amounted to, if you are a Jew, then you're automatically saved. He said, for you to think that was a mistake. That has never been a promise that God made to the Jews. Then he started talking about, so where are we today? And by today, I don't mean our today, today in the time of Paul. So where are we today? Where we are today is the Jews have rejected the Messiah. It's the Gentiles who are interested in and curious about and are receptive and open to the truth about the Messiah. And as he puts it, the Jews have stumbled over the stumbling stone. They have rejected the one that God sent to be the king of the kingdom of God, and God's own people, the Jews, have rejected him to their destruction. And in rejecting him, and largely they rejected him because they rejected the very idea of a crucified Messiah, and because they rejected the crucified Messiah, they have rejected the God's basis for dikaiosune, that is the Greek word that means pardoned from our sins and granted eternal life instead. They have rejected the basis for dikaiosune that God has supplied and are banking on their own basis for dikaiosune. And Paul is arguing that is to their own destruction. But the Gentiles who've been open and receptive to it, they are going to be given the blessing of eternal life that was promised to God's people, the Jews, but the Jews are rejecting it. So it's going to the Gentiles. And Paul says that's just exactly like the prophets predicted, that God would stretch out his hands to a disobedient people all day long, and they would remain stiff-necked and disobedient and rebellious, and God would then turn and give their blessings to a people that's not even a people, the Gentiles. And that's where we left off at the end of chapter 10. So as we begin 11 then, the question is going to be, well, what exactly does that mean, Paul, then? If the Gentiles have been open and receptive and the Jews have been closed and stubborn and disobedient, what does that mean? Has God rejected his own people, the Jews? That's where we start in 11:1, paragraph 93, sentence 1 in my translation. I ask then, God has not rejected his people, has he? Of course not. Indeed, I am an Israelite from the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he previously chose for himself. I'll stop there. As I said, the question is, has God rejected then his own people? He says, no, of course they haven't. And then he cites himself as an example. I'm an Israelite. I'm of the seed of Abraham. I'm of the tribe of Benjamin. I am one of the people chosen by God. Now, why is that relevant? I don't think Paul is making an argument. I don't think Paul is saying, because I'm a Jew and I have been accepted by my belief in Jesus, therefore God has not rejected his people. Because that's really not the question. The question is not, are there any individuals who can be saved? The issue is, has God completely rejected the people as a people group? It doesn't follow that because an individual has been saved, that God has not rejected the people as a people group. He could very well reject the people group and yet save an individual. So his own case as a believing Jew does not really prove anything, except it proves that God is still active among people who identify themselves as Jews. So I think the question that he's responding to is, has God's rejection of the Jews been a final and absolute and, I guess that's the word to use, an absolute rejection of his people, to which his own case is an answer to that question. No, he has not absolutely rejected his people. God has given me life because of my belief in Jesus. So God has not absolutely rejected his people whom he previously chose for himself. Let me back up for a second. You think of Sodom and Gomorrah, something that a chapter earlier he talked about. There was the possibility that God could have come in and totally wiped the Jews off the face of the planet. And he would have been right to do so because they had been disobedient for generation after generation after generation. And Isaiah is the one that he quotes saying that if I had not kept for myself a remnant, you would have become as Sodom, you would have become as Gomorrah. God would have and could have wiped them off the face of the planet, but he didn't. I think that's the kind of rejection that he's talking about here in paragraph 93. Has God come to a point where he has finally, totally, absolutely rejected his people? No. I'm a member of those Jews who still believes and still has a viable relationship with God. Sentence 4, God has not rejected his people whom he previously chose for himself. If you look at that in another translation, they will probably translate that whom he foreknew. Let me talk about that word for a second. It's unfortunate that our English translations translate that foreknow. It's understandable why they do, because the word comes from the word for before and the word for know that often gets translated know. But the concept of knowing something to the Hebrew mind and the way it gets translated into Greek, to know something is to come into an intimate connection with something. Knowledge is when I come into a close and intimate relationship with reality. It's an intellectual relationship, an epistemological relationship. You know, I make contact with reality because my beliefs are picturing reality the way it actually is. And my beliefs bring me into connection with reality if my beliefs are true. So the ultimate idea of knowledge is to be connected with it and be in association with it. I think that explains why the same word can be used. I used to think that it was a euphemism, but I don't think it's a euphemism. If you remember back in Genesis, Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore a child. Why the verb knew? To know is to simply enter into an intimate association and relationship with somebody or something. And then the context determines what that relationship is. In Genesis 1, it's sexual intimacy. Here, it's a different kind of relationship, obviously. For God to know a people is for him to draw them into an intimate association and connection with himself. He chose them to be his people. He chose them to be the people who he would uniquely relate to, such that he would be their God and they would be his people. And that's to know them. So to foreknow them is simply to have chosen in advance that he would have this kind of relationship with this people. So it doesn't literally mean choose, as I've translated it, but I think that captures the point that he's making. God has not rejected his people, whom long before, in advance, he entered into a special relationship with, an intimate relationship with, such that he knew them as his own people. He has not rejected those very people that he previously knew for himself. I hope that's clear. But in order to not have to explain that, I just paraphrase it, whom he previously chose for himself. Okay, then going on, or do you not know what the scriptures say about Elijah as he pleads with God against Israel? Lord, they have killed the prophets. They have torn down your altars. I alone remain, and they seek my life. And what does the divine oracle say to him? I have kept 7,000 men for myself who have not bowed the knee to Baal. The story is probably familiar to you. Elijah at this time was prophesying in Israel to King Ahab. King Ahab, right? Yeah. To King Ahab, who had a wife, a notorious wife named Jezebel. And there's the famous account where he has this contest up on Mount Carmel, and the priests of Baal pray to their Lord to bring fire from heaven to light the altar on the top of the mountain, and nothing happens. And then Elijah says, he puts an offering on the altar and he has them douse it with water, saturate it with water, make it as difficult as possible for the water to be consumed by fire. And Yahweh from heaven sends a bolt of lightning that not only devours the offering, but the altar and all the water itself, and just blasts it. And then Elijah proceeds to kill with his sword these priests of Baal. The word gets back to Jezebel that he has killed all of the priests to her god, and she sends message back to Elijah, you killed my priest, you're dead. You're going to be dead like they are. And Elijah runs. He runs first to Beersheba, and then he goes into the wilderness. God meets him there and tells him to head to Mount Horeb, that is Mount Sinai, where Moses received the Ten Commandments. He goes to Mount Horeb. Finally, at Mount Horeb, God meets him there and says, what are you doing here? And Elijah twice tells a little, apparently, looks like it's a recited or rehearsed story. Lord, they have killed the prophets. They have torn down your altars. I alone remain, and they seek my life. And he says that twice and answers the question twice. Finally, God tells him, and this is the part that Paul quotes, I have kept 7,000 men for myself who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Elijah was feeling alone. He was feeling probably a little sorry for himself. He was feeling isolated. He was feeling vulnerable and threatened. And God says, I want you to go back up to Israel. I want you to appoint this guy king of Aram. I want you to appoint this other guy king of Israel. I want you to appoint Elisha as your heir, as a prophet. And don't worry about them. I have kept 7,000 people for myself who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Well, Paul then takes that as his point of departure from making a claim about his time. In the same way, therefore, there is a remnant in the present time in accord with the choice of his grace. So just as in the time of Elijah, however alone Elijah might have felt, there were actually 7,000 men in Israel who had remained faithful to Yahweh himself. And notice the language that he uses. I have kept for myself these 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. I have kept them for myself. That's key to Paul's point. God kept them for himself. He says, in the same way, therefore, in the present time, there is a remnant in accord with the choice of God's grace. So Israel may be disobedient, just like they were in the time of Elijah. Israel may be godless and rebellious and stubborn in their unbelief and disobedience. That may very well be. They are today just as they were in the time of Elijah. But even though the nation as a whole is stubbornly stuck in unbelief, God has nevertheless kept for himself what he calls a remnant of Jews who are not unbelieving, who are not disobedient, who are not ungodly, but are people who are open and receptive and obedient to God. They are people who have believed that Jesus is the Messiah, and Paul himself is one of that remnant. Now Paul makes a parenthetical comment. Now, if it is by grace, then no longer can we think that it is by virtue of practices, works is the usual English translation, then no longer is it by virtue of practices, and those would be the practices required by the Mosaic covenant that he has in mind, for then this grace is no longer a grace. Now, I tripped over this for a long, long time in my study of Romans because it's so easy to want to have everything that he says be about justification by grace and not by works, because we are kind of programmed to think that's what the whole book is about. The problem that I always had, and it didn't bother me, I went ahead and taught it this way anyway, but the problem I always had is, why is that relevant here? That makes absolutely no sense in this context. He's coming along talking about an entirely different question, namely the remnant of Jews that still are a believing remnant in this time. And now all of a sudden he raises the flag of justification by flag, justification by works. He raises that flag and waves it all of a sudden, just in case you forgot or something. I mean, it's really strange. But this time through, I realized, I think, what he's talking about. Now, if it is by grace, now why is that even triggered in his thinking here? It's because of that language that God used in talking to Elijah. I have kept for myself. God is the one who makes believers believers. God is the one who takes people and bends their hearts, directs their hearts like water to go toward him rather than away from him. I mean, no one believes unless God makes them a believer. So he either takes a person and keeps them, that is, safeguards them in faith and obedience and godliness, safeguards them to keep them for himself as qualified to be his children, or he hardens them. But it's God who's sovereignly in control of that whole process. So if anyone believes, it's a gift. And I think it's best to think of grace here. We would probably use the word gift in this context. Therefore, there is a remnant in the present time in accord with the choice that is his gift to us, that is his gift to those individuals who make up the remnant. But if it's a gift, then no longer is it by virtue of the practices of the covenant, because then this gift wouldn't be a gift. So you see what he's saying, and that he's thinking more of his own time than he is of Elijah's time, although it would have been true in Elijah's time as well. But if these 7,000 men in the time of Elijah kind of stand out, then they stand out because they're not practicing their religion and their faith the way all of their fellow countrymen are practicing their religion and their faith. They aren't being just a normal Jew of their day. What would a normal Jew of Paul's day look like? You would keep the Sabbath and keep the dietary regulations and do everything that a Jew does in obedience to the Mosaic covenant. That is, you'd live like a good Jew. But if the remnant, if all it took to be a part of the remnant was to live like a good Jew, then it wouldn't be a remnant, he's saying. Because all the good Jews are living like good Jews. But it's only a remnant of those good Jews who are analogous to the 7,000 men in the time of Elijah who had not bowed the knee to Baal. Only some of them. So Paul's point is, it takes more than being religiously Jewish to be one of those people who's being kept by God. What does it take? Well, in his time, it takes believing that Jesus is the Messiah and not rejecting that and not forsaking forsaking God's covenant and God's promises. Forsaking is not the right word. Not denying the legitimacy of God's promises and God's covenant as applying to Jesus. Okay. What then? What Israel is seeking, that Israel has not obtained. What were they seeking? Dikaiosune. They were seeking the pardon that for their evil and seeking to have God's blessing granted to them. What Israel is seeking, that Israel has not obtained, yet the chosen have obtained it, he says, and the rest were hardened. Okay, now who are the chosen? He's not talking about us Gentiles here. What he's talking about, notice the context, is the analog to those 7,000 people in the time of Elijah. In the time of Elijah, there were 7,000 chosen ones who had not bowed the knee to Baal. Paul says in the present time, there remains a remnant. There's a chosen remnant who have not rejected the claim of Jesus that he is the Messiah. They have embraced the idea that he's the Messiah. So even though Israel is a people group, can be characterized as having missed out on the blessing that God has in store for them. Nevertheless, there's a chosen few, the remnant, who have obtained it. The rest, he says, were hardened. And then he quotes Isaiah, and followed by a passage out of Deuteronomy, and then a psalm. It is as is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that do not see and ears that do not hear, down to this very day. And David says, let their table become a snare and a trap, even a stumbling block and a retribution to them. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see, and bend their backs through everything. We won't go to those Old Testament passages because I don't think they elucidate Paul's point in any significant way. He's simply describing the reality of that he's already described in Romans. When God has compassion, he gives people eyes to see, he melts their heart, he melts away their rebellion, and makes them receptive to God's truth. Otherwise, they are hardened against it. And he is quoting these passages that he say describe the present-day Jews, the contemporaries of Paul. They're in a stupor, they're blind, they can't hear, they are stubbornly rebellious against God. That's why they have not believed that Jesus is the Messiah, he's arguing. That then leads him to a follow-up question in 11:11, paragraph 96. I ask then, they did not trip such that they fell, did they? The question he has been answering is, has God absolutely and ultimately rejected his people? The answer was no. God is still active among his own people. There's a whole remnant of people who have actually believed that Jesus is the Messiah. But there's another question, and that is, okay, so there are individuals in whose lives God is active. He's chosen them and made them recipients of the promises of Abraham. But what about the people group? Has the people, as a people group, have they tripped and stumbled and fallen? And what would it mean for them to fall? Have they so messed up that God is not going to keep his promises to the people group as a people group? It's critical to see that, because if you don't see that, none of the rest of what he has to say will make sense. Or at least you'll have to make it say something different than what he's saying. It's crucial to understand what question he's answering. Did Israel stumble such that the people who are chosen to be the people of God will never ever be the people of God? The promise goes all the way back to Abraham. Abraham, you're going to have a seed as numerous as the stars of the sky and the sand of the sea. I will be their God, and they will be my people. I'm going to take them into this land that I am going to give to them, and I will secure them in the land, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. That's the promise that's in view here. Well, Paul is saying, has God simply reached out to individuals among this people and granted them the blessing of Abraham? Or is God ever going to get around to actually keeping the promise that he made to Abraham? Will he take them into the land and secure them in the land, and he will be their God and they will be his people? Will that ever happen? Or have they messed up so badly that there's no going back, that God has decided, forget that promise, I'm not going to keep that promise to them? That's the falling that he has in view here. I ask then, did not trip such that they fell, did they? Of course not. Rather, at the occasion afforded by their transgression, salvation came to the Gentiles in order to make them jealous. Now, if their transgression was riches to the world and their failure was riches to the Gentiles, how much greater will their fulfillment be? Okay. In the purposes of God, he's saying, when God set his own people on the shelf, if you will, or shoved them to the side, why did he shove them to the side? He only shoved them to the side in order that he might turn to the Gentiles and offer the blessings that were promised by birthright to the Jews, to offer that to some Gentiles. That's why he did that. It wasn't because he intended for them to be permanently and forever sidelined. He has not forever sidelined his own people that he chose. He has only set them aside for the time being while he deals with offering his mercy and grace to the Gentiles. As we will see as he develops his ideas, the time is going to come, however, where he will turn back to his own people, the Jews, and give them that which is theirs by their birthright. So the first point he's making is simply, sidelining the Jews is not rejecting them. Sidelining the Jews is part of God's purpose in order to take his message to the Gentiles. So rather, at the occasion afforded by their transgression, salvation came to the Gentiles in order to make them jealous. Now, what is he referring to? He's not making this up. He's looking at Deuteronomy. Or he's thinking in terms of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 32, I'm going to read 15 through 22. So this is Moses speaking to Israel just on the threshold of going into the promised land. But Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You are grown fat, thick, and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scorned the rock of his salvation. They made him jealous with strange gods. So they as Israel, the Jews, the chosen people, made God, their God, jealous with strange gods, he says, idols. the gods of the heathens around them. They made him jealous with strange gods, with abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons who were not God, to gods whom they have not known, new gods who came lately, whom your fathers did not dread. You neglected the rock who begot you and forgot the God who gave you birth. Yahweh saw this and spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and daughters. Then he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be, for they are a perverse generation, sons in whom is no faithfulness. They have made me jealous with what is not God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols. So I will make them jealous with those who are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled in my anger and burns to the lowest part of Sheol and consumes the earth with its yield and sets on fire the foundations of the mountains. This is what Paul has in view when he says in order to make them, rather, by their transgression, salvation came to the Gentiles in order to make them, the Jews, Israel, jealous, just as Moses had predicted God would do. Now, if the Jews' transgression was riches to the world, to all the Gentile peoples over the whole world, if their transgression ended up being this rich reward to the Gentiles, and their failure was riches to the Gentiles, how much greater will their fulfillment be? So he's saying, if it's a big, huge deal, an amazing thing in the purposes of God, that God sidelined his own people for the sole purpose of bringing the richness of the blessings that he had promised that was theirs by birthright and take it and give it to the Gentiles, if that's an amazing thing, if that's a remarkable thing, a noteworthy thing, how much more amazing, how much more remarkable, how much more noteworthy when God turns and gives to the Jews the birthright that he has promised them for thousands of years? That'll even be more amazing. That'll even be more spectacular than what God has done to bring his blessing to the Gentiles. So now he turns and he addresses us Gentiles directly now. Now I am speaking to you who are Gentiles, inasmuch then as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I glorify my service, if somehow I might provoke my kinsmen to jealousy and save some from among them. Provoke them to jealousy in the way that Deuteronomy was talking about. So even though my focus is on taking the message to the Gentiles, I would be delighted if by taking this message to the Gentiles, it provokes some of my own fellow Jews to that kind of jealousy that makes them not want to lose out on their birthright and that they come back, return, repent, and embrace it. Now, if by their rejection, the rejection of the Jewish people, they're being sidelined. Now, if the sidelining of the Jews is the reconciliation of the world, us Gentiles, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? That is, they're being sidelined generation after generation after generation after generation of God's own people going to eternal destruction because they don't know God and they have rejected his Messiah. When God finally reconciles them, it'll be like life from the dead. It will be as amazing as a kind of resurrection. And then he explains why. If the first piece is holy, the lump is also. And if the root is holy, the branches are too. It's a fairly simple analogy, actually. What he's saying is, in the Mosaic Covenant, one of the commandments in the covenant is whenever you make dough, if you have a batch of dough and then you're going to take a piece to make a biscuit or a pancake or something out of it, the very first piece of dough that you take from the lump of dough that you've made, you need to wave it before God. I don't know what that looked like. But whatever waving that before God, you do it. And why do you do it? It's a ritual. It's probably a lot like us saying grace before a meal. It's just a routine and a ritual that God required of them, instructed them to keep. And I think the logic of it, and that's what goes into Paul's point here, the logic of it is, as so many things in the law, you offer a portion to God precisely because it all belongs to God. If the peace belongs to God, it's because the lump belongs to God. If the peace that you're offering up to God is being sanctified and set apart and offered to God, it's because by rights, the whole lump belongs to God. So I think the peace of lump, the analogy is between the fathers and the nation that comes from them. If the fathers were holy, if the very first of the Jewish race, if the very first representatives of the Jewish race were holy, and clearly they were if you read the Genesis account, if they were holy, then the whole lump is holy. If they were holy, the whole nation is holy. That's why it is life from the dead when the day comes that that very people become reconciled to God. Then it's that which has always, forever, for thousands of years, been holy in the eyes of God is now finally coming into their own, realizing their promises, realizing their birthright, realizing their true identity in relationship to God. It will be life from the dead, he says. And then he shifts the analogy. If the root is holy, the branches are too. The root are the fathers. Where do these generation after generation after generation after generation of Jews come from? They are all descended from, and they all identify with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That is their root, if you will. And everything that makes them a Jew, the nutrients that give them their significance and identity as a people, flow through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, this is key. To understand Paul's whole point from here on to out, we need to understand what the branch is. A lot of interpreters get this wrong because they take the branches to be individual people. And individuals are either grafted in or broken off of the root. But that's the wrong way to think about what Paul is saying. Because Paul is envisioning many generations of Jews who have been broken off. He's already talked about them in the earlier chapters. So the generation comes along, and that generation, if you characterized it as a whole, is a disobedient and rebellious generation. Next generation comes along, it's disobedient and rebellious. Next one comes along, same thing. Next one comes along, same thing. So we'd have this trunk of a tree with all the branches broken off as time goes into the future, branch after branch after branch after branch is broken off because they have not turned to the Lord their God and known him and loved him and obeyed him and sought to serve him. So think of these branches as generations. Now, if some of the branches were broken off, and you, remember, he's speaking to the Gentiles now, being a wild olive, were grafted in among them and became a partaker of them, of the rich root of the olive tree, then don't be arrogant toward the branches, that is, toward the branches that were broken off and by rights belong on that trunk. That is, we Gentiles, we have no right, we have no birthright that makes us recipients of the promises and the blessings that were given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those belong to the Jews by birthright. And there were generation after generation after generation of Jews who held that as their birthright, that what was promised to their fathers belongs to them. But they got cut off because they didn't have the faith of their father Abraham. They didn't have the obedience of their father Abraham. They didn't have the heart of their father Abraham. And because they didn't have the heart of their father Abraham, they were cut off from the promise and the blessing and the rewards that were theirs by a birthright. So he likens us to a wild olive tree. That is, that we are generation after generation after generation of people whose roots don't go to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but are elsewhere, other people groups. We don't belong in that trunk. But nonetheless, you being a wild olive were grafted in among them and became a partaker with them of the rich root of the olive tree. But don't think of yourself as a branch being grafted in. Think of our generation of Gentiles being grafted in. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot of Gentiles who are not receiving the blessing of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But he's speaking relative to the Jews. Relative to the Jews, the stubborn rejection of Jesus by Israel, by comparison, this generation of Gentiles has been significantly more receptive than this generation of Jews. And as you go back through time, you could say the same thing in the last generation, in the generation before that, and the generation before that, all the way back to Paul. From Paul forward in time, as each new generation comes along, the Gentiles have been receptive and the Jews have not. That's how he's thinking here. Okay? So don't think in terms of what individuals are or what individuals are doing. So if you are inclined to, don't be arrogant toward the branches, he says. If you are inclined to be arrogant, you do not bear the root. The root bears you. This is an absolutely crucial statement. It's the one that the Gentile Christians did not heed, I would argue. If you look at the history of Christianity is Gentile Christians rejecting the root and inventing a new religion. So we turned the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob with all of its expectations and all of its promises and everything that goes with that. It's the Messiah promised to them that we believe in. But we transformed that Messiah into a Gentile Christian Messiah rather than the Jewish Messiah. If I were teaching a Christmas message today, I'd go back to Luke and look at all the things that it's so interesting that Christmas is a Christian holiday and celebration, but the story is a thoroughly, unmistakably, and unrepentantly Jewish story. And you look at what the angel said, you look at what Anna said, you look at what Simeon said, you look at what Elizabeth said, you look at what Mary said, you look at what Zacharias said in the opening accounts of Luke, and every one of their statements is thoroughly and ridiculously Jewish. And it's not at all Gentile Christian. We have been grafted into their story. And yet, what is our attitude? Our attitude is, well, you Jews can get in on this thing. Just reject your Judaism, become Christians, and you can get in on this thing. Paul would go, what? What are you thinking? You don't even belong here, dude. You're lucky to have any part and any role and any place in this thing at all. You have been grafted into their story and their birthright and their promises and their reward and their blessings, and you're there by the grace of God. And God made no promises to you. He doesn't even owe this to you in any sense at all, in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't belong to you. So you should just be thankful that you have anything to gain by this at all. But instead, we have become arrogant toward the branches. And he says, if you're inclined to be arrogant, keep one thing in mind. You do not bear the root bears you. We should etch that on our walls and remind ourselves daily of that. You will say then, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. Look at all those generations of Jews who have been sidelined. And not, I mean, that sidelining them is literally cut off from eternal life, cut off from the blessing. All those many generations who've been cut off from the blessing, they were broken off that I might be grafted in. Here's a Gentile speaking, a generation of Gentiles speaking. Branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. Good for you. They were broken off for their unbelief. and you stand because of your belief. Do not be conceited, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, he will not spare you either. So it's only if we persevere in belief that that this is ours. Now again, it's tempting to think as an individual. If I as an individual persevere in belief, then I will get there, but if I stop believing, I'll be cut off. That's true, but that's not Paul's point. Paul's point is, it's only as the generations of Gentiles continue responding in belief that indicates God's purpose is to take this message to the Gentile world. But if the Gentile world stops responding receptively to the gospel and believing, then that's the end of the Gentiles, as we'll see here. Let's go on. For if God did not spare the natural branches, he will not spare you either. Behold then the kindness and severity of God. To those who fell, the Jews, severity. But to you, you Gentiles, God's kindness, if you continue in his kindness, otherwise you too will be cut off. Again, he's not talking about individuals. Even though that statement could be made in another context to individuals, that's true, that we need to persevere in our faith if we're going to get to the end and get eternal life. But that's not his point. His point is, you Gentiles as a people group, an identifiable group of people, you will continue in his kindness. That is, God will continue to take from among you people that he's going to give this blessing to if you continue in his kindness. But otherwise, when you stop being receptive to it, then the Gentiles will be cut off just as God cut off the Jews. He will one day sideline the Gentiles when they cease to be receptive. And when is that going to happen? Well, let's go on. But they too, if they do not continue in, but they too, on by the same token, they, the Jews, they too, if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again. A generation of Jews is going to come along who are not going to continue in their unbelief. They are going to turn to God and be receptive, and they are going to believe. And what will correspond to that? Them being grafted back in to their root. The blessings, the covenants, the promises that God made to their fathers. Now, if you were cut off from what according to nature is a wild olive tree and were grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more certainly will these, in accordance with their nature, be grafted into their own olive tree? And you see his point here. It's very profound. If God went out of his way to make you a part of the blessings that he promised through Abraham, and you don't even really have a right to it, do you really think God is going to take this people who have a right to it and not bring them back in and grant to them the blessings that are theirs by a birthright that he promised them thousands of years earlier? Do you really seriously think he's not going to do that? I mean, he didn't even have to do that for you, and he did that for you. He, in a way, kind of has to do that to the Jews because he, like, made a promise to them. So if he gave it to you and he hadn't promised you anything, you can bet he's going to give it to them because he promised it to them. How much more certainly will these, in accordance with nature, be grafted into their own olive tree? Now, brothers, I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, or secret would be a better word. Now, brothers, I do not want you to be ignorant of this secret, lest you be wise by your own estimation. A partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, and so will all Israel be saved. Now, what does he mean by a partial hardening? I think what he means by a partial hardening is even though we've had multiple generations of Jews who have been hardened against the truth of God's promises, it's not absolute. It's not complete. It's not entire. It's only part of God's people who have been hardened against the truth for a segment of history. But the time is going to come where there's going to be a generation of Jews who are not hardened against God. They are the other part. It's only part of God's people throughout time who have been hardened against it. But the other part is still in our future. I mean, there's always been a remnant, of course, all along that's part of the other part. But the part that he has in mind is there are going to be generations of Jews of whom it can be said, God is their God and they are his people. They are not going to be hardened against God. They are going to be truly acting like the people of God, just like he promised to Abraham. So, as Paul is writing in his day, and I don't think Paul had any idea how big a part this was going to be, but as he's writing his day, just because all the Jews around me are hardened against the truth of the Messiah and don't believe, that doesn't mean that that's going to be the destiny of the Jews forever throughout all time. This is only a partial hardening. It's accomplishing the purposes of God for now, purposes that God predicted all the way back to Moses. God predicted this would happen. It's part of his purposes, but it's also part of his purpose to bring his own people to repentance and renewal and restoration so that they will no longer be hardened. Brothers, I do not want you to be ignorant of the secret, lest you be wise by your own estimation. A partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so, and by that he means, it's in this way that all Israel will be saved. The point that he's making is it's this way rather than what other way? The other way that all Israel would be saved is for God to make a promise to Abraham about his people, and his people would believe, and they'd get on with them being the people of God, and God being their God, and they'd prosper in the land, and all the promises would be fulfilled. It didn't happen that way. That's the secret. The secret was that when he promised it to Abraham, he didn't necessarily include the bit about all of God's people for generation after generation after generation after generation for a really long time, not getting it and not being responsive. That's the secret that you need to add if you're going to understand the purposes of God. But the time is going to come when he says at the time of that the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. I don't know how else to read this than to assume that what he's saying is there's going to come a time in history where God is going to stop working among the Gentile people. God is going to stop pulling out for himself from among the Gentiles people to be a part of the eternal people of God. The Gentiles are going to become like the Jews are, have been for generations. We are going to become asleep, blind, deaf, stubborn, in rebellion, disobedient, and we're just going to be unresponsive. Now, again, I'm not talking as individuals. I'm talking in terms of a whole generation. What's going to characterize the generation? It sure looks to me like in America, that's already happening. My hope, my desire, is that the stories you hear out of China and out of India and out of Africa are still authentic, bona fide work of the Spirit of God calling Gentile peoples to himself. It's just us he's abandoned. But there's still vast numbers of Gentiles in the world that are being called to God. And perhaps the time of the Gentiles is not yet complete. But the day is going to come where God is done adding to the number of the eternal people of God all the Gentiles that he intends to add to that number. And when that day comes, he says, that will be when the partial hardening that happened to Israel will come to an end. Then all Israel will be saved. Then we will enter into a time of history where all of Israel will be saved. And he says, it is just as it is written, there will be a deliverer from Zion. He will turn away ungodliness from Jacob. This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. Okay, I have to make a decision here. I don't think I'm going to be able to finish the chapter, and there's probably some significant things to say about that quote from Isaiah, so I think I'm going to take one more week, and we'll finish chapter 11 next week. So I'll come back to that. I don't really know what's going on there. That Isaiah 59 passage is very complex. The Septuagint, the Greek translation, reads a little bit differently than the Hebrew translation. Figuring out what the significance of that is gets very difficult. Knowing what Isaiah is talking about is difficult, and I'm not going to solve that by next week. So I think in the end, there's more to be said that I'm not going to be able to say about that. But I think I understand what he's saying in this context. It's the turning away ungodliness from Jacob that is the critical piece. And I think the Isaiah 59 passage that he's quoting, Paul is reading that as a prediction of that day when God is finally going to return to his people and is going to save them by turning their hearts back to God. And it's at that time he's going to turn away ungodliness from Jacob. They will no longer be asleep. They will no longer be blind and deaf. They will no longer be stubborn and stiff-necked and disobedient and rebellious. God is going to remove all that ungodliness from them, and they will be a people who are responsive to their God. But we'll... there's not a lot there, but I'll stretch it out next week and leave a lot of time for questions next week. In the meantime, let's take some time for your questions here.
It's kind of difficult to kind of explain what I want to say, but one thing that comes through my mind when you're talking about the branches. The branches breaking off, being the Jews, and that somehow it seems like we are being put in those places that were meant for Jews. Sometimes it sounds like God has a specific number in mind. But, I mean, I don't really think that, but I can see where that could be understood. Is this something
Two things. I mean, in a sense, of course, he does have a specific number, because from before the foundation of the earth, literally every individual that he intended to make his forever has already been determined. So if God can count, he has a specific number in mind. You know? However, having said that, that's why I keep stressing, probably ad nauseum, that these are not individuals. The branches are not individuals. They're generations. And Paul's point is that generation after generation, according to the script of history, according to his purposes, as each new generation came along, when God had made it his purpose to call from out from among the Gentile people to be his for eternity, during that time, he did not have his attention focused on saving his own people, the Jews. The only thing that he's really adamant about here is that for whatever reason, God's purposes involved only dealing with one at a time, Jews or Gentiles. Now he's working on us Gentiles. The time is going to come when he's done with us, and that he's going to turn his attention, he's going to pour out his spirit on his people, the Jews, and write his law on their heart, and they will be his people, and he will be their God.
Yeah, well, part of my experience is, well, if you didn't know where I came from, you could hear in my voice, I've come from the South. It's just Baptist doctrine of once saved, always saved, and those types of things resonate so heavily. And reading this, I think someone with that type of doctrine say, oh, here, see, you know, God has done that, and it doesn't matter what I do, which... A lot of Baptists, at least in the South, have this kind of idea that, you know, God has elected me and that's it. You know, it doesn't really matter what I do. It's like God has said, you know, you're going to be one of mine, and that's settled. So.
Well, those are the kinds of issues that we get really turned in knots over in Romans 11. If we think of the branches as individuals, because
right.
If you think of the branches as individuals, you can be in the trunk one day and out of the trunk and cut off from the trunk the next. Or if you assume once saved, always saved, then you do other kind of weird things with this. But that's not what he's talking about. And it's that's what I mean by getting rightly oriented to the issues of this chapter. It's very important that we not make this chapter about us as individuals and our salvation, because we're going to get just all convoluted and confused. He's talking about God's purposes and God's script for history from beginning to end in this chapter. That's the issue, is that in history, way, way, way back when he made a promise to the Jews, is he going to keep it or isn't he? That's the question. Well, that can be kept thousands of generations later. But in the meantime, you've had generation after generation after generation after generation, and that's what the branches correspond to. I think I quoted this a few weeks ago, but remember in Deuteronomy, he says, the iniquities of the fathers are visited on the second and third generation, but the chesed of God extends to the thousandth generation. And I think what he's saying is, God may very well make the children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren of a stubborn and rebellious set of Jews pay, in a way, suffer for the iniquities of their parents. But God will never, ever, ever forget the promises he's made to them. To the thousandth generation, the iniquities of thousands of generations are not going to prevent God from being faithful to the promise he made to the first generation. His chesed extends to the thousandth generation.
Yeah, and one thing I was wanting to kind of point out too is, it's so many Christians, and I was talking about this, I don't want to pick just on the Baptists, they're not the only ones, but it seems like a lot of Christians are getting this type of idea that the Jews were getting. That the Jews were getting, that, you know, there's these promises and so on, and taking something that is meant for a group and saying, because I am of this group, I'm automatically. And, you know, I see that a lot in so many denominations. They're just, you know, I'm Baptist or Christian or whatever, and because of some particular doctrine, see, I come out of Methodist, and I'm a firm believer in the Wesleyan tradition and what he did. But some people are looking at that and kind of what Wesley did, but aren't following anything that Wesley did. And I think that's a lot with the Jews. It's, they proclaim Abraham, Moses, and so on as a progenitor. And it's like, okay, because of them. But they don't look at themselves and take into effect that I am individually responsible to God. It's not just what group I'm in.
Right, right.
Hey, Jack. You've definitely, if you've hit home one point today, it's been take this chapter as referring to generations, not as individuals. And so I suppose I'm just having... I don't want to think that in this short time that I've, likely what I've stumbled across is my own lack of understanding. So I just want to throw out a few things, and if you could just help clarify why we have to read this in terms of generations rather than individuals.
Okay.
The first thing is that, and I'll just kind of do a quick little, the points that at least jumped out to me that were kind of question marks. The first one was when he comes out of the gate and says, you know, did he reject his people? No, look.
I'm sorry.
The first one's when he comes out of the gate, and you had mentioned this yourself, that the question, if the question's, is God going to save a generation of his people, Paul referring to himself as an individual doesn't seem to answer to the call of the question.
Right.
And then your way of taking that was that he is maybe answering a slightly different question, that is God rejecting his people presently in their entirety, which might be right. What struck me in this section was he kind of draws an analogy between himself and Elijah. You know, he's an individual that's been saved, and so likewise, Elijah was an individual that was saved among the Jews. But in Elijah's day, there were a number of Jews, 7,000, that had been saved, and so likewise, in his own day, there's been a number of Jews that have been saved. And then the rest were hardened, section 95, verse 3. But then, and then there's all those, the Isaiah, Deuteronomy, and Psalm that were just, your commentary on those, which is right as far as I know, is that those are just elucidating the analogy of what it's like for the rest of the Jews in his own day, namely those who were hardened in his own day and in past days as well, drawing that analogy between the past and the present. But then when he picks up in 96 and he says, I asked then, they did not trip such that they fell, did they? I feel like he's, the natural referent there is the remaining Jews who are hardened in his own day. So it seems to be there, I was kind of struck by how it's not really about a generation, it's about those who have been hardened and those who haven't been hardened. Because, yeah, at least immediately, it didn't seem to be primarily about an entire generation. And then he talks about among those that have been hardened in his own day, how much greater would their fulfillment be? And then he talks about in the next section that he does his own service so as to provoke some of my kinsmen to be saved from among them. So again, like, there's this group of hardened Jews. Are they hardened so that you could just wash your hands of them? No. He hopes, even in his through his own work, to steal some over through jealousy, you know, of what, I don't know how his own service would do that, but that seemed to be...
Don't drop your voice.
Sorry. So there's those, and then with the section of the branches and the roots, the point... Well, I maybe have already said too much. The one last thing was that with generations, I mean, it seemed... I liked your point, if I was understanding it correctly, that... The issue about, I don't know about the lump thing, I kind of spaced out at that moment. It was kind of
funny. Did you say that about the lump thing?
Yeah, the lump thing I kind of spaced out at that moment, but the root thing I caught on was that, there's no reason for them to be arrogant in as much as it's the root that sustains them, not vice versa. Right. And then I felt like the pole of the argument was kind of Paul saying, so don't look at these branches who naturally belong to this root, don't look at them despicably. But it seemed to be like individuals too. They're just kind of been the natural way that I've been reading that in the past. And it's, so it's kind of natural that I'd read it this way now, despite the warnings. And the last part that I get how it could be generations, but I didn't understand how it could be a generation of Gentiles, because even in their own day, it's not a generation of Gentiles that's believing. It's probably a smaller fraction of the Gentiles that are believing than Jews who are believing. And we have to admit that the most successful Jewish movement in the first century is probably Christianity. So they probably pulled in a number of Jews by comparison to other movements. So, yeah, if you could just kind of answer.
Okay, I think what I'm going to do is next week, let me answer your question, because I'll have plenty of time and I'll go through and explain why I think my reading makes more sense. Because I'm not arguing that you can't read it the other way, because you could, as long as you conveniently ignore certain pieces of it. Then you can go a long way, as many theologians and Bible students have, can go a long way towards saying, well, no, this is just talking about individual Gentiles getting grafted into what isn't theirs by birthright, and other unbelieving Jews are broken off and don't get in on it, and that's what he's talking about. And I think you could go a long way and make sense out of it in that particular way. You'd have to reformulate what the question is, and that's part of what I'm going to answer is that part of what my answer will be is you run into some strange paradoxes, I think, when you try to transform the question into something else relative to his answers. But let me explain that next week.
Cool.
But I stress so much that these are generations, and I do think that, but it's not like you can't read it another way and go a long way toward making a certain amount of sense out of it. If I'm right, though, notice the irony. The irony is that if I'm right in the way that I'm reading it, then the other way of reading it actually turns it completely on its head. because Paul's point is that we Gentiles do not replace the Jews as the people of God in his promises and purposes. That's how many, many people try to read this, that it's now this group of Gentiles and Jews together that God has chosen for himself. We become the true Israel. We become the people of God. We are the real people that are going to have these promises fulfilled. And has God rejected his own Jews as that people? You betcha. Yeah, he has. He's defined a new group as this Jewish-Gentile amalgam of believers. Well, if I'm right, that's terribly wrong. That's exactly the opposite of what he's saying. Is what he's saying is, as big a deal and as amazing and noteworthy and wonderful as it is that we Gentiles get in on this thing, that wasn't the promise. And the promise still needs to be fulfilled. And when it is fulfilled, it will be like a resurrection from the dead when the day comes that that's fulfilled. So I'm arguing for exactly the opposite of what many interpreters do when they read this chapter. Look, oh, sorry, Chris.
Well, maybe you'll continue this next week. But yeah, I guess mine was just a general question in the vein of Jonathan's. That, I mean, at some point, you know, all of us need to, you know, what are the implications, I guess, is my question for the individual. For the individual that, the individuals that Paul is writing to, or, and that are, that will read it. I see what you're saying about how it's important to recognize that it's about, and he's talking about generations, and yet, you know, as I read it, as his audience, each individual reads it and hears it, what are the implications for those individuals?
Yeah, relatively few and far between. This is not a very practical chapter for you and I. But this letter wasn't written to you and I. It was written to a group of Gentiles in Rome who are about to experience an onslaught of Jews returning to Rome from being kicked out of the city. And they're coming back as unbelieving Jews, as Jews who are hostile. He's going to, in the section we didn't get to yet, he'll talk about, for the sake of the gospel, you are enemies because of the gospel. That is, there's enmity between the Jews and us Gentiles who believe that Jesus is the Messiah, because they don't like Jesus being the Messiah. The whole letter is written to equip these Gentiles who have not had to deal with Jews for 5 or 6 or 7 years, get them understanding the relationship between Jesus and this whole history of Judaism so that they can be equipped when the Jews come along and say, yeah, but that renegade idiot, Paul, he didn't know what he was talking about. Look, if Paul is right, look at all these promises that God hasn't kept to his Jews, blah, 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 blah. And the impact of that to the Gentiles, Paul realizes, can be really corrosive. If they're not ready and equipped to understand, how does this exactly fit in? How does Jesus fit in with the history of the promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? And all the implications of that. That's why this chapter is here, is he wants them to be ready when the Jews come back and say, don't you dare listen to that renegade Rabbi Paul. He is making all this stuff up. This is totally inconsistent with Torah. This has nothing to do with the promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, the poor Gentiles saying, oh, I thought it did. I thought he told me it did. And if they're not really ready for it and equipped for it, their faith is going to be hammered.
That makes sense.
So that's why he's writing this.
That's the relevance to, yeah, he's writing it to individuals in another sense.
Or, exactly.
But it's not, okay.
I think my question is along the same lines when you said that one believing Jew does not a people make. And so Paul,
could you repeat?
One believing Jew does not a people make,
right.
Nor does one believing Gentile
right.
a people make.
Right.
And yet, at what point does that group of individuals become a people? At what point does that label people from God apply to them? Well, it doesn't really say. All he says is that, again, he seems to be saying, like I told you before, it's not all the Jews. It's a people within a people. And in Elijah's time, this 7,000 were the people that were within the people. And so that, I mean...
But I think he's looking forward to a day when the people is everybody.
Right, right.
And thus will all Israel be saved. I think that's what Joel has in mind. I think that's what Malachi has in mind. A lot of passages we've looked at here and there along the way where the prediction of the prophets is there's going to come a generation of Jews at the great and terrible day of the Lord that's going to be fisher cut bait time for his own people, the Jews. And they're either going to believe or not believe. The ones that don't believe and continue in their unbelief literally get destroyed by the invading armies or locusts or whatever it is that is coming. And what's left behind is a generation of people, every last one of which is a believer, you know, that God has poured out his spirit. As Jeremiah 31 puts it, no one will need anyone to teach him to know the Lord, for they will all know me, he says. So the least of them to the greatest of them. So there is going to come a generation of Jews in fulfillment of what he's looking forward to, where the people will be everybody.
So Paul is sort of saying, I'm sort of like one of those 7,001 Jews in the time of Elijah. God has always kept the remnant, which he's told us before. I mean,
right.
He keeps saying it over and over and over again. So I guess up to that point, it makes perfectly good sense, which is why I just got to think there's a people within the people of the Gentiles as well.
Right.
There's just this small little remnant, this
right.
little demographic that's scattered all over the world.
Yeah, see, that's the difference between the Jews and the Gentiles, that there have been a remnant of Gentiles who know God, as have there have always been a remnant of Jews who have known God. But what will never be true of any Gentile is we will never be a people of God. As Americans, we are not the people of God. The Chinese will not be the people of God. The Irish will not be the people of God. The French will not be the people of God. No Gentile people can ever say, we as a people have this unique relationship with God. That hasn't happened and it never will happen. Because he didn't say in Deuteronomy, I'm going to go and make those people who aren't a people. He said, I'm going to turn to those people who are not a people. Well, turn and do what? Not make them a people, but he's going to offer the blessings and the promises. He's going to graft them in to the riches of the root that belongs to the people of God. And that's why, I mean, in a sense, his analogy gets kind of loose here, and this is part of Jonathan's question, but the imagery of a branch from a wild olive tree being grafted in is not meant to suggest that they become the people and therefore every last Gentile will be saved in that generation. That's not the point. The point is that generation is deriving benefit from the root. And how are they deriving benefit? Because some from among them are receiving the eternal life that was promised as a blessing to Abraham. One last question, then I need to let you go. Hi.
So I guess my question would be, in terms of reading history, maybe I'm a little more skeptical than you are about reading history, but it's like...
I'm sorry about...
A little more skeptical about reading history than you are, at least in the sense that it just seems like there's lots of fluctuations in history. At the time of the Reformation, you know, they saw, you know, the Roman church is falling into great disgrace and basically, you know, Christianity is ruined and we need to basically rebirth it. And in large ways, they were, you know, a lot very successful. I mean, Europe went from a time of being very dark to having a lot of lights shone forth. And then, in America, you had the Puritans come here and they founded and did, you know, what they thought God was calling them to do. And then their children were born and they're like, hey, they're all heathens. And then the Great Awakening came in America and all of a sudden it was better than it was before. And it's just like these fluctuations in history, you know, in America. Is America going down with, you know, the rest of Europe and getting more dark, or will it be a reawakening or things like that? It's like, and it's just, for me, it's hard to know. It's hard to say, you know, this is the closing of America per se. It's like, well, maybe. I mean, it could be, but maybe not. Like, and so, I mean, am I just a pessimist? Am I just an optimist to say, well, maybe, but maybe there's another Luther in America, or maybe there's another, you know, another awakening or something. I guess that would be the hope, I guess. But
yeah, maybe no, and no problem. I mean, I welcome you having that hope. I pray to God that this is not the end of our culture and our civilization and the degree to which truth and light has affected our culture. I pray to God that that's not true. But I guess my only point was sometime, somewhere, one of us is going to be disappointed. I mean, one of us who pray to God that that not be true, God's not going to answer that prayer. The time is going to come where there will be an end to the light among the Gentiles. And I'm not a prophet. I don't know when that is. Because you're right. At the threshold of the Reformation, things were incredibly dark. And yet God turned Western civilization around. Could he turn American civilization around? Yeah, absolutely. Will he? Don't know. But I hope so. But as every day goes by, he has a lot more work to do if he's going to save this thing. Need to let you go. Sorry I kept you so long.